Let's talk about the future of news.
I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
The state of journalism today.
Telling both sides of a controversial story.
I think you must be unbiased.
It's honesty, fairness, truth.
That is our job. That is our job. That is our job. That is our job.
Welcome once again to the Our Man in Stockholm podcast, or Yokoso, as I'm reliably informed by Google that they say in Japanese. I'm coming to you today, or whenever you listen to this, from Enoshima, which is where the Olympic sailing is taking place at the Tokyo Games 2020. If you're following me on social media, you will obviously know that this is where I've been for the last 10 days or so. I've been in Japan for the last 10 days or so. I got back to Enoshima yesterday. Doing a podcast in these circumstances, you know, regular listeners will know that I like to do this podcast every week. I like to sometimes, or most of the time, have a guest. That's not all possible, and that's not always possible, and certainly not possible at the Olympics, where everything is chaos. So I just thought I'd give you a little bit of a postcard from Tokyo or from Japan, and just let you in behind the scenes of what it's like to be here. Some of that you can gather from social media, some of it you just can't, because, you know, there's not enough tweets, there's not enough video, you can't do certain things on video from mix zones, that kind of thing. So I got here, I flew out of Stockholm on last Monday week, and that was the start of a very long journey. So it's, you know, it actually started beforehand, because there was all sorts of protocols put in place. You had to take your temperature for 14 days before departure, and you had to have a health report that was ready to upload to a local app. And the app is basically, you know, almost Orwellian in the way it's steering everything that happens over here. So a couple of negative COVID tests later, and it was onto the plane to Vienna, and then from Vienna to Narita Airport, just outside Tokyo, or in Tokyo. So once we got there, we had been told that because we're going to the Olympics, they've modified everything for the Olympics. They're saying, okay, journalists can be here, but they have to take part in a modified quarantine program, which is 14 days long. And that means not being able to do a whole lot. It means having to fill in your details, your health details every day, take your temperature every day, and tell them if you've any symptoms whatsoever. So, you know, this app activates pretty much when you hit the ground here. And they also have, you know, it's basically tracking on your phone to make sure that you don't go where you're not supposed to go. So we're supposed to, you know, limit, obviously, all contact with people. And it doesn't matter if you're vaccinated. I have my EU vaccination certificate, and they just go, you know. I believe that there wasn't a huge amount of people vaccinated. By the time I got here, it was like, you know, just under less than 10% of the country. So they're not really thinking in those ways. So they wanted everybody to basically stay out of, you know, not be in circulation with Japanese people, if at all possible, and to stick to the Olympic bubble. So we got to the airport, and we were told that it could take up to 4 hours to get through the airport. And this is one of those things, it's like, oh God, always check your documentation. So the couple of certificates that I had from a very good company in Stockholm who performed the test very, very quickly and sent me the certificates. But unfortunately for me, on the certificates that they sent me, signed by a doctor, there was one tiny little box for the type of test that had been administered. It's the one that goes up your nose and tickles your brain looking for COVID. And that box wasn't ticked on the latest of the COVID tests. And that led to pandemonium. So we landed about 7:40 in the morning, I think it was. And the idea then, obviously, was, you know, by lunchtime, you'll be out of there, you'll be in your hotel, you can have a snooze, and you can start sort of dealing with the jet lag, right? But no. So I ended up having to go through the whole thing, and they take you out of the line, and they go, okay, this is a problem. All your other documentation is great. And there was a lot of documentation, but this one doesn't work. So they said to me, you're going to have to call the doctor. Okay, so at that point it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. It was 11 o'clock in the morning here in Japan, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning in Stockholm, and there's no doctor going to answer then, you know. So I said, okay, I'll send a text to the guy at the clinic that I've been in touch with and see what happens. And remarkably, at, you know, 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning, this is why they're such a great company, he responded. And he said, okay, I'll get on to that. And he got the doctor out of bed, and he got them to make a new certificate, and they ticked all the right boxes, and they sent the PDF to me. So that put me back into the process of, you know, of being processed and all my documentation being gone through again. And that was cool. So that was fine. That was like 4 hours, maybe 5 hours it took to get to that point. But it didn't really speed up after then, right? So the next thing you have to do is a saliva test, which is a bit weird because you're standing there spitting into a tube. Now, you're not, you know, as if you were sort of, you know, spitting on the ground, you know, you're just sort of dribbling into this fucking thing. And they're looking for a specific amount. I can't remember how many milliliters it is, but, like, you know, after the first sort of, you know, drool, it kind of dries up. So it's really embarrassing. And the unfortunate thing is we had to do that every day for the first 3 or 4 days, and then we have to do it every fourth day, and we have to do one on our 14th day. And those things, are you drop them off at the centre, so you're walking around with a test tube of your own spit in your hand or in your pocket, and you got to drop it off somewhere, and they test it and they make sure that nobody has COVID. Now, there is COVID here, you know, so within the Olympic bubble there have been athletes who've tested positive, there have been close contacts, there has been one person I know who tested positive for COVID, and that person is now in isolation, no names mentioned. So, you know, the system is working, but it's really, really limiting. So when we got to the hotel in downtown Tokyo, the Olympics is essentially, it's less to do with sport and more to do with organisation and logistics, right? So it's just like, if you can imagine putting together an entire transport schedule, an entire infrastructure for a small town or city in the space of maybe a year, that's what they were trying to do. Now, people would argue that they should have done it better, but Tokyo's public transport system is one of the best in the world. So when the Games were awarded to Tokyo, they pretty much would have said, okay, we're probably not going to need that because you can get anywhere quickly, cheaply and safely on public transport. But you can't do that in a pandemic where the vast majority of journalists are working on this modified 14-day quarantine where we can't be out in public and we certainly cannot be on public transport. So they put the buses in there and it works. Sometimes some things are inexplicable, and I'll tell you more about that a little bit later. So yeah, we got here, we got sorted out. We went to the MPC, which is the main media center, or the media something center, I can't remember what all the acronyms mean. And then you get all your, you get these like tablets to chew in case you're sweating too much, you know, and it helps you rehydrate, rucksacks and media guidebooks and handbooks. And then it's time to sort of head off to your venue. So I'm covering two sports: surfing, which was taking part in the early part of the games and is now actually over, and sailing. And being aquatic sports, we thought, okay, I'll just go to Enoshima and I'll base myself there and I'll go to the surfing every day. The problem is that the surfing venue is about 2.5 hours away from Enoshima driving, and that's not allowing for the Olympic buses and that kind of thing. So it quickly became apparent that I was going to have to go and be put in a hotel, the Olympic hotel, near the surfing venue, which was only like 15 minutes from the beach. But the problem was that I was already 2.5 hours away. So I ended up having to haul my ass all the way back from Enoshima north up through Tokyo and then to the surfing. Once you get to outside the city here, language does become an issue, right? So there are certain people, I've noticed for some reason, there's a lot of people from Nepal who are working here in the hospitality industry. They're working at the hotels, right? And the people here are magic, right? You've been told the whole time that, oh, you know, the Japanese people don't want you here. The Japanese people don't want you here. And that doesn't matter because, you know, they may not want us here, but they're still really courteous, really polite, extremely helpful, couldn't do enough for you. You know, there's thousands, if not tens of thousands of volunteers who are giving up their time to make sure, you know, they're just standing at the bus stops to make sure that we can find out where we're going. They're sort of dotting the paths to make sure we find our way to the events and into the media centres and from the media centres to the mix zones. And they're lovely. And the hotel staff, even if they don't speak English, that's hardly their fault. They probably don't get a whole lot of English speaking tourists out this way, but they're still immensely helpful in everything that they try to do. So I arrived up to this place and it was, I think it was called the Kujikuri Spa and Resort Hotel and Taiyo no Sato or something like that. It was out by this beach and it's a famous, famous surfing area. This is where, you know, the spiritual home of Japanese surfing is. So the beach where the event was taking place is called Surigasaki. And there was a bus every hour to that beach, but the way the surfing competition works, like obviously you're depending on weather and waves, you know. So on Sunday, I think it was Sunday, the first day of competition, so I was probably up there for the first time on Saturday, the waves weren't great. It was like really poor. And they were going, okay, everybody else at the Olympics was going, we want good weather. We want, you know, we don't want rain, we don't want wind or that kind of thing. And the surfer's going, please send me a typhoon, right? Send me some sort of wave that I can do my stuff on and look cool in front of the world, because surfing was making its debut. So while everybody else was nailing everything down, a typhoon was forming way off the Japanese coast and the surfer's going, yeah, yeah, give me this. Surfing making its debut. It's the Olympic program is reviewed reasonably regularly, and new sports are put in and old sports are taken out, and there's a lot of people look at things like surfing and snowboarding, especially the non-racing variants of it. Okay, so windsurfing has been part of the Olympics for a little while, but surfing is, you know, they're scored on the tricks that they do, the size and power of the waves that they do them on, and that's, you know, it's basically a judgment sport like gymnastics or anything else. A lot of people believe that, you know, if you don't have to cross a line first, or if it's not done on time, or if it's not done on knockouts, that, you know, it doesn't belong in the Olympics. The problem is that, you know, those people need to sit down, because sport is not just what you like and it's not just what you think it is, right? I'm not a big fan of sailing. I'm going to enjoy it whilst I'm here, but it's just, it's one of those sports that I have never done. haven't watched it a whole lot. I don't understand it, and I'd be the first to admit to it. I certainly don't understand it to a degree that an Olympic athlete would. But I can't just say, that's irrelevant. That's unimportant. All those people who like that, you're wrong, right? Because there's a home for literally everything in the Olympics. I was never a big fan of gymnastics, despite growing up in the era of Olga Korbut and Nadia Comăneci from Romania. There you go, that's showing my age. But I never once said, okay, that shouldn't be part of it. You know, let's take all the things that girls like, or let's all take all the things that, you know, African athletes are good at. You know, that's not what the Olympics is about. So surfing is after appealing to a whole new category of person, just as snowboarding has done in the Winter Olympics, right? Younger people, the X Games generation, the Red Bull, Monster Energy generation. And it was a huge thing for them to be involved. And these are people, and I spoke to one of them, these are people who probably didn't enjoy the competitive thing, or, you know, like surfing and skateboarding are the kind of things where competing is actually kind of looked down on. You know, they will be the people who say, hey, it's not about that. It's not about points and medals and money. It's about doing cool things. It's about being true to who you are and expressing yourself. You know, there's more art almost than sport in it. So one of the guys who was part of that, you know, back in 2016, it was announced that surfing was going to be part of these games. And one of the guys who in 2015 spoke to a friend of mine and said, maybe this is not for us. Maybe this is not the kind of thing we should be doing, is a guy called Owen Wright, an Australian athlete. And he, you know, looks like a surfer dude, sort of the sun-bleached locks and, you know, in his 30s, laid-back character, slightly long hair, really well able to speak. Owen suffered a traumatic brain injury in a training accident in 2015. And not only could he not surf, he had to learn to talk again. He had to learn to walk again. He had to learn to get up on a surfboard again. He had to, you know, he had serious problems with his memory, you know. So he'd be sitting there, and he told me this the other day, he'd be sitting there with a spoon in his hand going, I don't know what this is called. So he got a smack of the head off a surfboard while training, and it caused a bleed on his brain. And that caused enormous trauma. So it took 3 years for him to get back to anywhere close to where he would have been. And he was one of the top surfers. He would have been, you know, I think he was on the pro, the surf tour, the championship tour, it's called. The CT is what they call it for short. But he was one of the guys who thought, you know, maybe this isn't for us. And then he told me a great story about that when they were trying to convince the Australian surfers, you know, Stephanie Gilmore, who's like, you know, this iconic female surfer, 7-time world champion, she took part in the women's event. But Owen was telling me that they brought all of the Australian surfers into a room, and they brought in some Australian Olympians, right? One of them was the 400 metres champion from the Sydney Games called Cathy Freeman, a native Australian woman who I still remember, like, I, you know, shivers running down my spine thinking about her winning her gold medal in Sydney for her people, in front of her people. One of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And Owen told me about her coming into the room and talking about being an Olympian. And he said that all the Australian surfers were just sitting there crying at the end of it. And she and a guy called Kenny Watts just convinced them. It's like, right, okay, this is it, we're doing this. This is what this means. And you fast forward then, that was in 2016, and you fast forward 5 years, and I don't know what day it is now. I think today is Thursday, and the surfing finals were moved forward by a day to make the most of the tail end of the typhoon waves. So on Tuesday, Owen won his quarterfinal. And then he got into the semi-finals where he lost, but he won the bronze medal competition against Gabriel Medina of Brazil. And Gabriel was really, really disappointed, didn't speak to the media afterwards. But Owen, after all he'd been through, and after being so doubtful to taking part in the Olympics, was there with a bronze medal around his neck. This is a guy who couldn't walk 5 years ago. And it was just one of those amazing things that stuck out for me. Now, the winner was also, like, everybody has a story here. And that's the great thing about the Olympics, is that there's so many stories to tell. The winner, Italo Ferreira of Brazil, he comes from a tiny place up on the northeastern coast of Brazil. It's something, Bahia something, I can't actually remember the name of it, though I wrote about it the other day. It's just north of Recife, where I covered the World Cup in 2014. And there's about 10,000 people who live in that village, and everybody was behind him, or a small town, 10,000 people. And he started to surf on the lid of his father's cooler bin, right? You're just not going to get, you know, a more humble beginnings to an Olympic career. And this is exactly what I wrote about him afterwards. There's nothing more humble than being so poor that, you know, it's not, hey, Dad, can I have a junior surfboard? I'm 6 years old and I want to learn to do this. And him going, yeah, no problem. Let's go down to the local store and we'll buy this, the most expensive one, and you will be an Olympian. I was like, no, get that lid and get out to sea and fucking see what you can do. And here's this guy, and he was an amazing athlete, because after a while you start to recognise, even if they're standing at a distance, you start to recognise the form of somebody's body, the shape of their shoulders, their hair, their head, their moves. And he was, from the very beginning, from the first time we saw him in the surfing competition, you could see he was very aggressive, really, really powerful, physically powerful individual for a small guy, and really controlled. So his thing was that didn't matter what the conditions were, you know, if it was knee-high waves on Sunday, or if it was like the really choppy, messy, early breaking waves on Tuesday, this guy was able for it. He didn't care. He just threw himself straight at it. And it was, there was such joy in what he was doing, but there was also power and intent. And he won. And, you know, at 12 years old, he was still borrowing surfboards off his cousins because his parents couldn't afford it. But he was discovered at 12 years old, and then he became a junior prodigy, and he went on and, you know, on Tuesday, he became an Olympic gold medalist. And in between those two then, on the podium was Kanoa Igarashi, whose father, and this is it, like I say, the stories are everywhere. Kanoa Igarashi's father, his nickname is Tom, grew up surfing on that Tsurigasaki beach. Like, the beach where the Olympics was held is where Kanoa's father learned to surf. So when his father and his mother discovered that she was pregnant, he went, I want to give my son the chance to be a professional surfer. We're leaving. So they quit decent jobs in Tokyo and they moved to Huntington Beach in California. So they basically dedicated their whole lives, right, everything, uprooted themselves from the culture, moved to California, and Kanoa then became this professional surfer. And he's 23 years old, so I think he lives in Portugal now. But his thing is that, you know, speaks English, obviously surfing for Japan, so surfing for his father's and his mother's homeland, and indeed, of course, his own their homeland. Speaks Portuguese, which is brilliant because there's a big Brazilian population who watch this as well, and obviously speaks English because he grew up in America. So this guy's the golden boy, you know. Now, I think his hair colour, unlike Owen Wright, is slightly more, maybe that came from the hairdressers and not directly from the sun, but an amazing kid, and talking about building bridges, and a superb surfer as well. Now, it didn't go well for him in the gold medal match, and he said afterwards that maybe my strategy was wrong. He seemed to be really tense. He seemed to be looking to, you know, looking for the knockout blow, looking for the one wave that was going to get him a 10, and that was, you know, then he just needed to add a half-decent one to that, and he was going to beat Ferreira, but that, it just never happened for him on the day. And surfing is so humbling in that way, because, like, you know, if Mother Nature doesn't give you what you need when you need it, then you're not getting it. And you have to accept that. And you have to accept that the other person is better on the day. You know, now Medina, who came fourth, and I have a huge amount of sympathy for the guy, you know, but that really hit him hard. He felt hard done by, you know, because he didn't get a medal. He got so close to an Olympic medal in a historic first games, and it just didn't work out for him. So it was an amazing experience to be up there. But to see these people, and this is the great thing with the Olympics, when you're used to covering other sports where, you know, you can't just call up people anymore. You can't just talk to people anymore. You know, who are you, journalists, talking to us, right? And the more I do these events, the more I write the reports, the more I think that what's important is not what I'm writing. What's important is what these people are saying. It's more important to let them tell their stories in their own words. You know, I can add things, I can add details, and I can add colour, and I can add context and that, but it really has to be born. Even the basic, you know, event reports that come out pretty much straight after it's all done, you're almost dependent on having one or two quotes, and let them decide the angle of what it is that they want to say about the event that people have just been watching. And that, to me, is where it's at now. You know, it's not my job to tell you what you've already seen on the TV, right? It's not my job to tell you what you can see on Google, or what you can see on Twitter, or what you can see on the Olympic website. My job is to tell you what they don't tell you. You know, you as a listener, as a viewer, as a reader, don't have access to those people in the moments after, which is what I do. So that's the value that I can bring, is talking to these people and bringing the quotes and these fantastic stories afterwards. So the thing about the Olympics as well, it's not only is it this huge logistical organizational challenge, once something is done, it's over. So by the time the press conference was finished in the media center by the Tsurigasaki beach, you could see the volunteers and the people running the media center and everything just sort of high-fiving one another, because their Olympics was over. It was supposed to finish on Wednesday, but they moved it forward on Tuesday, as I said, to get the best of the waves. And they were done. So, you know, they might move off to something else, but that was the first part of their thing done. So they're going around high-fiving one another. And they're already starting to take down, you know, TV towers and move things elsewhere, you know, because it's a huge operation. So that's fine. We get outside. We're done. We got the bus outside. We've been there. The competition started. We were on site at 6:30 in the morning, and the competition finished. We left at 8:10 in the evening. So the last stories were filed onto the bus back to the hotel. Only about 15, 20 minutes. So 8:30, you get there. All the restaurants are closed, because all the restaurants close at 8 o'clock in Japan at the moment, as far as I know. So we went to a convenience store, reliably told they're called konbini in Japanese, and you go and there's all sorts of, you know, ready to eat stuff there or stuff that you can take home and heat up, you know. So we just got a couple of sandwiches, went back to the hotel room, flopped on the bed. But I knew that, you know, no more than the volunteers, that their thing was over. I had to go, I had to move on quickly the next day and get back here to Enoshima. So I got up yesterday morning at 6 o'clock. I have a little coffee pot with me, so I made some coffee and I had one of those sandwiches from the convenience store, and I went out and stood at the bus stop at 6:23 in the morning and said, right, let's go, here we go, back to Tokyo and then down to Enoshima. And I was told that I'd be collected in Enoshima from the MTM, which is the main transport mall. This is where all the buses go to in Tokyo, right? So it's basically a big bus station for the Olympics. So I go out at 6:23, no bus. I went, okay, maybe I'll check the app. So I checked the app and the 6:23 bus disappeared. And I said, oh, there's a bus at 7:23, but no bus then either. I thought, ah, shit, here we go. So there's a number you can call. I call the number. It's like, where's the bus? They go, oh, there's a bus at 7:23. No, there's not. I'm standing right here. There's no bus. And it's written on the bus stop. It's everywhere. And then I checked the timetable. And even the post-competition days, there were supposed to be buses, but they just weren't there. Nobody told anybody. So we're getting up towards, there's a system of taxis here where they give you vouchers, right? Because you're not allowed to use public transport. Otherwise, I just would have gone to the local train station, got a train back to Tokyo. So, there's a system of vouchers. So they gave you 14 vouchers. And the vouchers, I think, they're worth, nominally, they're worth about 100 euros each. So then I went back into the hotel and we had to go through this thing of, you know, the girl not speaking great English, me speaking little or no Japanese, because you have to book a specific company because they have a deal with the local organizing committee for the Olympics. And eventually, after booking the wrong taxi once, we got the right company and she got a taxi and the taxi showed up. And me and my photographer, buddy, Lisi, we got in there. And he drove us back to Tokyo at a cost, I think, on the meter, but the time we got it was like 300 euros or something like that. But that's fine because this is the Olympics and it's these things have to be done. So we handed over our vouchers, no money changes hands, the Olympic Committee pays that. Dumped out of the hotel. And then I was picked up an hour later and brought down to Enoshima. So you're quickly moved from one to the other and you have to insert yourself very, very quickly in what's happening. Now, I've been following the sailing and I've been writing about the sailing from where I was. And now it was just a case of getting back to, okay, now you're in the middle of this. Who do you need to talk to here? And that's really what today is about. I went directly to the venue yesterday and I wrote something from the venue and I got to do the same thing again today. But today, I kind of know what way the competitions are going. So sailing, there's lots of sailing to decide who's going to go for the gold medal races. So like there's 10, sometimes 12 races in each class. So a lot of that, you know, who wins what specific race is not really interesting. It's really the incidents that happen. You know, we had a Swedish boat capsize yesterday briefly. So that was, you know, that was a note of interest just to illustrate what the weather was like and what the competition was like and how tight it can be in there. So today I'm going to head off down there. The sailing starts at 5:05. So I'm going to head down there and I'm going to see what's going on down there. I'm going to find some people to talk to because, like I say, I can tell you the stories in timings and I can tell you the stories of winners, but that doesn't actually tell you anything at all. So what I want to do is I want to tell you the stories, the people behind them. So I have a few people in mind. I'm not going to mention any of them because, you know, you never like to give hostages to fortune in this game. Say, I am going to speak to or / interview this person, and then you don't get them and then you feel disappointed and readers feel disappointed because maybe somebody really wanted to hear it and yada. So yeah, that's what's on for the day. From here, this goes on. The medals start here. I'm talking to you on Thursday. The medals start here the day after tomorrow, which is Saturday, and they go on for 5 days, right? There's 10 gold medals over 5 days, which is cool because it, like, you know, instantly you've got stories to write about. Instantly you know what people you're going to write about because they're going to be on the podium in front of you. So that will take me up to Wednesday. Wednesday then I get the hell out of here and I go back to Tokyo. And from Tokyo then we got 4 days of boxing. And for me, that's the culmination of the Olympics, right? Ever since I was a kid, watching on Irish state television, RTE, and listening to, there's a broadcaster called Jimmy McGee in particular who used to commentate on boxing and Olympic boxing. And it just, you know, it's just one of those things. If I ever got here, I always wanted to do it. And now at the age of 50, in the year of our Lord 2021, I'm finally going to get to do that. There's loads of stuff I left out. There's loads of things I can tell you. So you can sign up aramanstockholm.substack.com. There's going to be a newsletter over the weekend with some of the stuff that I haven't told you about here. There may even be some of the stuff I have told you about. I'm getting to the stage where I'm old enough now to be repeating myself. And then there'll be another podcast, possibly somewhat similar to this one, at some point next week. If I can find somebody, one of the guys I'd really like to talk to here is a photographer called Carlos Maria. And Carlos from South America, he worked at the White House for many years. He's a tremendous photographer, and I would urge you to go and check out particularly the Reuters pictures, because like Lisi who was with me at the surfing, like, her pictures were just amazing. And Carlos is just an incredible photographer. And he's out there on a boat every day, risking seasickness, trying to take these brilliant pictures. And he's just a tremendous photographer. Some of his pictures are of Donald Trump that he took during all his years covering the White House were just amazing. So if I can, I'll talk to Carlos about those years. You know, if I can't, you know, I might get to talk to him on a bus someday, and we'll do something like we did in Copenhagen, where we did a little audio diary of a day here. I might do that at the boxing next week, actually. And I think that might be the way to approach this. I hope you're enjoying the sport. I hope you're enjoying whatever it is you're reading and listening to and writing. I hope you're enjoying what you're doing on social media. I hope you're enjoying your summer if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. And if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, I hope you're wrapped up nice and warm and waiting for the summer days to come again. Because believe me, there are still some great experiences out there, despite all that is wrong in the world and COVID and everything slowing down. And when you get the opportunity to go out and see it again, I would strongly recommend that you do so. Take care of yourselves, and I shall talk to you again very, very soon indeed.